Chapter 3. Being politically oriented, Nicholas had already noted the budding career of the junior senator from California, Ferris F. Fremont, who had issued forth in 1952 from Orange County, far to the south of us, an area so reactionary that to us in Berkeley it seemed a phantom land, made up of the mists of dire nightmare, where apparitions spawned that were as terrible as they were real, more real than if they had been composed of solid reality. Orange County, which no one in Berkeley had ever actually seen, was the fantasy at the other end of the world, Berkeley's opposite. If Berkeley lay in the thrall of illusion, of detachment from reality, it was Orange County which had pushed it there. Within one universe, the two could never coexist. It was as if Ferris Fremont stood amid the deserts of Orange County and imagined, at the north end of the state, the unreal thraldom of Berkeley, and shuddered and said to himself something on the order of, "That must go." If the two men, Nicholas Brady in the north and Ferris Fremont in the south, could have looked across the 600-mile distance between them and confronted each other, both would have been appalled. Ferris Fremont as much so as Nicholas Brady, who was already appalled as he read in the Berkeley Daily Gazette about the rise to political power of the publisher from Oceanside, who had gotten his chance in the Senate by defaming his Democratic rival, Margaret Berger Grayson, as a homosexual. As a matter of record, Margaret Berger Grayson was a routine senator, but the defamatory charges had formed the basis of Fremont's victory, not her voting record. Fremont had used his newspaper in Oceanside to blast Mrs. Grayson, and, financed by unknown sources, he had plastered the southern part of the state with billboards darkly alluding to Mrs. Grayson's sex life. "California needs a straight candidate. Don't you think there's something queer about Grayson?" That kind of thing. It was based on a supposedly actual incident in Mrs. Grayson's life, but no one really knew. Mrs. Grayson fought back but never sued. After her defeat, she vanished into obscurity, or maybe, as Republicans joked, into the gay bars of San Diego. Mrs. Grayson, needless to say, had been a liberal. In the McCarthy days, there wasn't that much difference in the public's view between communism and homosexuality, so Fremont had little difficulty winning once his smear campaign began. At that time, Fremont was a callow lout, fat-cheeked and sullen, with beetle brows and pasted-down black hair that looked greased into place. He wore a pinstripe suit and loud tie and two-tone shoes, and it was said that he had hair on his knuckles. He was frequently photographed at the target range, guns being his hobby. He liked to wear a Stetson hat. Mrs. Grayson's only rejoinder to him that ever received any favor was a bitter remark, made after the returns had come in, that Fremont certainly was no straight shooter, straight or not. Anyhow, Mrs. Grayson's political career was ended, Ferris F. Fremont's begun. He flew at once to Washington, D.C. in search of a house for himself, his wife, Candy, and their two bulbous sons, Amos and Don. Now, you should have seen the effects in Berkeley of all this shit. Berkeley did not take it well. The radical student milieu resented a campaign's being won on such a basis, and they resented Fremont showing up in Washington even more. They did not so much care for Mrs. Grayson as they resented the winner. For one thing, as Republicans pointed out, there were many gays in Berkeley, and there certainly were many pinkos. Berkeley was the pinko capital of the world. The pinko capital of the world was not surprised when Senator Fremont was named to a committee investigating un-American activities. It wasn't surprised when the senator nailed several prominent liberals as Communist Party members. But it was surprised when Senator Fremont made the Aramchek accusation. Nobody in Berkeley, including the Communist Party members living and working there, had ever heard of Aramchek. It mystified them. What was Aramchek? Senator Fremont claimed in his speech that a Communist Party member, an agent of the Politburo, had under pressure given him a document in which the CPUSA discussed the nature of Aramchek, and that from this document it was evident that the CPUSA, the Communist Party of America, was itself merely a front, one among many, cannon fodder, as it were, to mask the real enemy, the real agency of treason, Aramchek. There was no membership role in Aramchek. It did not function in any normal way. Its members espoused no particular philosophy, either publicly or privately. Yet it was Aramchek that was stealthily taking over these United States. You'd have thought someone in the Pinko capital would have heard of it. At that time, I knew a girl who belonged to the Communist Party. She had always seemed strange, even before she joined, and after she joined, she was insufferable. She wore bloomers and informed me that the Sex Act was an exploitation of women. and one time, in anger at my choice of friends, she dropped her cigarette in my cup of coffee at Larry Blake's restaurant on Telegraph Avenue. My friends were Trotskyists. I had introduced her to two of them in public, without telling her their political affiliations. You never did that in Berkeley. Liz came by my table the next day at Larry Blake's, not speaking. I think it got her in trouble with the party. Anyhow, one time, kiddingly, I asked her if she also belonged to Aramchek as well as to the party.
"What a crock," she said. "What a fascist lie. There is no Aramchek. I would know."
"If it existed," I asked, "would you join it?"
"It would depend on what it does."
"It overthrows America," I said.
"Don't you think monopoly capitalism, with its suppression of the working class and its financing of imperialist wars through puppet regimes, should be overthrown?"
Liz said. "You'd join it," I said. But even Liz couldn't join Aramchek if it didn't exist. I never saw her after she dropped her cigarette in my coffee at Larry Blake's. The party had told her not to talk to me again, and she did what it said. Still, I don't believe she ever managed to rise high in the Communist Party. She was a typical low-echelon type, devoted to following orders, but never really getting them right. Ever since, I've wondered what happened to her. I doubt if she ever wondered what happened to me. After the party pronounced the ban on me, I ceased to exist, as far as she was concerned. One night I had dinner with Nicholas and Rachel, where the topic of Aramchek came up. The Socialist Workers' Party had passed a resolution denouncing both Senator Fremont and Aramchek, one the arm of U.S. imperialism, the other the arm of militant Moscow.
"That's covering both bases," Nicholas commented. "USWP are certainly opportunists."
Rachel smiled the superior, sneering smile of a Berkeley poli-sci girl.
"Are you still seeing that guy?"
Nicholas said, meaning the SWP organizer that his wife had a crush on.
"Are you still in love with your boss's wife?"
Rachel demanded.
"Well,"
Nicholas muttered, fooling with his coffee cup.
"I think Fremont has a great concept there," I said. "Denouncing an organization that doesn't even exist, one Fremont made up and says it's taking over America. Obviously, no one can destroy it. No one's safe from it. No one knows where it'll turn up next."
"In Berkeley,"
Nicholas said.
"In Kansas City," I said. "In the heartland, in Salt Lake City, anywhere. Fremont can form anti-Aramchek cadres, youth groups on the right dedicated to fighting it, wherever it manifests itself. Armed, uniformed bands of kids, ever vigilant. It'll get Fremont into the White House."
I was kidding. But as we all know, I turned out to be right. After the death of John Kennedy and his brother's death, and the death of virtually every other major political figure in the United States, it took only a few years.